Lecture 17. To the Lighthouse. Life stands still here.
A generation or more ago, when I was in graduate school, if you had suggested to the professors teaching English and European literature that Virginia Woolf would loom larger in our literary consciousness and in the cultural imagination than Joyce himself, you would have been laughed out of the seminar. But the fact of the matter is that today, Woolf's eminence is so great that it is in some ways larger than Joyce's. There are certainly more scholars working both in European languages and in English on Virginia Woolf and on aspects of her work than on Joyce himself. And the Woolf industry continues to grow. There's an industry of scholars in many disciplines and many languages at work on her letters and diaries, her manuscripts, her portraits, as drawn and painted and written down by hundreds and maybe by now thousands of others. She's been the subject of several biographies, including a luminously powerful and intelligent biography by Hermione Lee, which I recommend very strongly and admire very much. There are a number of explanations for why Woolf has become such a looming figure in literary study, and I'll try to suggest some of them in a moment. But let me begin by saying a few things about her fascinating and prolific and in some ways tortured life. She was the daughter of a very famous literary figure and intellectual, Sir Leslie Stephen, who was an eminent man of letters, the founding editor of the British Dictionary of National Biography, the editor-in-chief of the Cornhill magazine. He is the model for Mr. Ramsay in To the Lighthouse. And the portrait of Mr. Ramsay is a complex and ambiguous one. Many readers, especially feminist readers, see the portrait as entirely negative. And there is something bombastic and domineering about his character, no question. And both Virginia and her sister recognize these qualities in him and discuss them. And when Virginia's novel came out, her sister wrote to her and said, you've caught our father to the life. But it is also the case that certain qualities in him, his intellectual restlessness, his ambitions, are very like those of Virginia herself. And the treatment of his character is more complex and more nuanced than some readers have recognized. His wife, Julia, was the kind of loving and nurturing woman who is celebrated also in To the Lighthouse in the character of Mrs. Ramsay. Virginia was part of a large and gifted family. Her sister was a painter. Her life, even as a child, was surrounded by artists, by poets, by painters, by philosophers. And in her adult life, she continued these kinds of associations and became the center of a virtual salon of such leading intellectuals and artists. Her mother, Julia, died relatively early from essentially angelic exertions in taking care of the family and contending with the bombastic demands of her husband. In a memoir that Virginia wrote decades later, published in 1939, just 2 years before Virginia's own death, Virginia recalled the extortionate, melodramatic grief of her father at her mother's death. And she recreates that extortionate, melodramatic grief in To the Lighthouse. An aspect of Virginia Woolf's life that no one can ignore and that gives a particularly powerful and poignant dimension to her achievement is the fact that she suffered for a good part of her adult life from what we now know was a form of schizophrenia. She attempted suicide a number of times, several times, and would have these episodes of madness in which she would hear voices speaking to her, was hospitalized a number of times for it. In her adult life, in her long and very nourishing marriage to Leonard Woolf, who cared for her in ways that everyone acknowledges, including Virginia herself, were remarkable, she suffered difficulties and was hospitalized a number of times. And of course, at the very end of her life, as she was finishing her last novel, Between the Acts, she began to hear the voices yet again. And she, there are some biographers who suggest that the advent of the Second World War was also part of what depressed Virginia so deeply at the end of her life. There were bombers flying across the English Channel, and the noise of war was very loud at the time. English society was deeply threatened by what was happening, and that may have been a contributing factor. But as most people know, she finally ended her life by committing suicide. She walked down to a river, put some rocks in her pockets, and walked into the river and committed suicide, died in the river. This symbolic drowning, water and wateriness is a central element in a lot of her writing. And in To the Lighthouse, there are scenes that describe the outer darkness as encroaching on the human community in a way that suggests both how terrifying but also how powerful and overwhelming that watery element seemed to Virginia Woolf to be. Her death has been dramatized a number of times, most recently, very powerfully, in the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Michael Cunningham that called The Hours, which actually recreates Virginia Woolf's suicide, reimagines Virginia Woolf's suicide. In some ways, the most powerful pages of that novel involve those scenes. And the novel also borrows very openly and systematically from one of Woolf's great novels, Mrs. Dalloway, and recreates some aspects of that novel as well. The novel, The Hours, was made into a movie, and Nicole Kidman, apparently a strange casting decision, played Virginia Woolf with a terrible false nose, making her look much uglier, in fact, than Virginia Woolf herself was. And Nicole Kidman won an Academy Award for the role. I mentioned this recent novel and the movie as a way of reminding us of Woolf's astonishing eminence, of the size of her reputation, as if she's now almost sort of entered the popular culture as well as the intellectual culture. Her novels are read, of course, in all universities, and now are very frequently read in high school. In my modern fiction courses in university, I often get students who come into my class and tell me that when they look at my syllabus, that they're happy to see Virginia Woolf on the syllabus, of course, but they also say, well, I've already read To the Lighthouse. And in those cases, I recommend that they read Mrs. Dalloway or another Virginia Woolf novel instead. And in a surprising number of cases, I encounter students who have just come out of high school who have read both of Virginia Woolf's masterpieces, Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse. Given the state of literacy of American high school students, this is a very remarkable fact indeed. Her eminence now is unassailably obvious and significant. But it's important to recognize that by the end of her life, even before she died, she was already a famous writer. One of the biographies of Woolf reports that the following lines written by a young woman in her diary in 1928, a student at Cambridge: "Lecture today by famous writer Virginia Woolf. Very boring." One explanation for Woolf's eminence has to do with the rise of feminism and the growth of gender studies. What scholarship is showing today about Virginia Woolf's advanced attitudes towards sexuality and gender has had a transforming effect on modern feminism. She's a founding lesbian in a certain way, maybe against her will. She was very diffident about these questions, even though it is now known that her long marriage to Leonard Woolf was almost certainly not physical, she did have an intense lesbian relationship with a dear friend, Vita Sackville West. One of the interesting things about this is that she was nonetheless diffident about identifying herself as a lesbian or as bisexual, and toned these matters down. In Hermione Lee's biography, published in 1996, where Woolf's diffidence is described, is very beautifully clarified and understood. She toned down the bisexuality and lesbian material in the fantasy novel Orlando, published in 1928, which is really a secret biography, a fantasy biography of her friend and lover, Vita Sackville West. And there's a section of her famous essay, one of the founding essays of modern feminism, called A Room of One's Own, published in 1929, which was much more, in its original version, was much more overtly in favor of or respectful toward lesbianism and or bisexuality, and she took that out of the manuscript and didn't publish it. These are, of course, the essays. The essay in a Room of One's Own began as lectures to the women students at Cambridge University, some of whom may have found her, surprisingly, very boring. In that famous essay, A Room of One's Own, one of Woolf's most remarkable and memorable strategies is to ask the question, imagine Shakespeare's sister. To our knowledge, Shakespeare had no sister. And Woolf says, imagine a sister of Shakespeare with Shakespeare's gifts, with Shakespeare's powers. What would a woman in the Renaissance have been able to do? Would her gifts, would her powers have been realized? Would they have come to fruition? And of course, the answer is they would not have, because women were not allowed to have an education. Women were second-class citizens. And that provocative question has resonated very powerfully, of course, and it's one of the passages in A Room of One's Own that is referred to most frequently in the feminist scholarship on that, in the scholarship on that important essay, on that sort of founding essay, that founding feminist essay. One of the things that's interesting about this is that we've learned that there was a deleted sentence in To the Lighthouse in which we can see Woolf had begun to toy with the, which appeared earlier than A Room of One's Own, in which Woolf had begun to toy with the idea of this metaphor or this provocative question about Shakespeare's sister as a way of dramatizing the inequality of gender inequality. And in the novel, the character who is closest to Virginia Woolf, a sort of Virginia Woolf stand-in, is the painter Lily Briscoe. And in the novel, Lily remembers a passage, thinks of a passage in which it goes something like this. It was a passage that she deleted from the novel. Lily Briscoe remembered that man has Shakespeare behind him and women have not. It's interesting that she took it out of the novel, but then obviously the idea resonated with her, and then she used it in the lectures that became A Room of One's Own. So Woolf's importance as one of the founding figures in feminism and gender studies can't be overestimated, can't be exaggerated. And even though she herself might not be entirely delighted to be named as a lesbian, there's no question of her importance in this enlarging in scholarly and intellectual territory. Woolf also played a central role, was the central figure in the chief avant-garde salon of her day, called the Bloomsbury Group, after the neighborhood in London, the Bloomsbury neighborhood in London, where she had her home. It's the neighborhood near the British Museum. She played with her husband Leonard. She was sort of the central organizing figure in that crucial British avant-garde, a group that included important philosophers, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, was a member of the group. E.M. Forster, the novelist, was a member of the group. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that Roger Fry, critic of painting who brought post-impressionism to England, to Britain, was a member of the Bloomsbury Group. Advanced thought of all kinds in England grew out of or emanated from this remarkable group of friends and professional writers and artists, including, we might say, advanced thought about sexual mores. I have an anecdote from a memoir that Woolf wrote many years after the event, remembering Bloomsbury. It's an essay that she wrote near the end of her life called Old Bloomsbury that captures one aspect of the feelings of the Bloomsbury group in being members of an avant-garde. This is Woolf from her memoir, Old Bloomsbury. Suddenly the door opened, and the long, sinister figure of Mr. Lytton Strachey stood on the threshold. Lytton Strachey, of course, was the author of the famous book Eminent Victorians, which was a kind of modernist attack on the pretensions and sentimentality of the Victorian era, and he was a member of the Bloomsbury Group as well. Suddenly the door opened, and this long and sinister figure of Mr. Lytton Strachey stood on the threshold. He pointed his finger at a stain on Vanessa's white dress. "Semen?" he said. "Can one really say it?" I thought, and we burst out laughing. With that one word, all barriers of reticence and reserve went down. A flood of the sacred fluid seemed to overwhelm us. Sex permeated our conversation. The word bugger was never far from our lips. We discussed copulation with the same excitement and openness that we had discussed the nature of good. It is strange to think how reticent, how reserved we had been, and for how long. Well, this is Wolfe looking back on the era when the Bloomsbury Group was at the center of British avant-garde thought. And it's a good, helpful reminder to us of the importance, the centrality of themes connected to sexuality and physicality in modernist literature generally. Even though Wolfe's own writing, fiction, does not directly confront these questions, clearly it was something that was at the center of her thought, and there are oblique ways in which these matters do emerge. And she does dramatize a kind of androgyny, a kind of suspicion of gender roles, again and again in her books, often obliquely, but often very powerfully. The figure of Lily Briscoe in To the Lighthouse is a very clear and, in many ways, powerful instance of this, and this is a matter to which I will return, at least in some degree, in the next lecture, focused on To the Lighthouse itself. Wolfe was also a critical, had a critical role as an essayist. She was one of the great literary critics of her day, and her essays are still marvelously readable. She was responsible for embodying an ideal of literary discourse as a form of conversation and speculation and moral judgment, something of a lost art, I think, especially in the United States, but maybe even in some degree in Great Britain. There are 19th century masters who embodied these qualities. Matthew Arnold, De Quincey, Hazlitt. In some way, Virginia Woolf is their heir, is their most distinguished 20th century heir. Many of the essays which she published, many of them were published anonymously in the Times Literary Supplement in an era when the TLS did not publish bylines, were collected in a series of books that themselves very influential as forms of literary criticism. The two most famous of these books are titled The Common Reader and The Common Reader's Second Series. Savor that title. I do. The Common Reader. It implies a community of literate amateurs, a reading public, a genuine reading public, an audience that cares about literature and art for its own sake, not to credentialize itself, but because it's a part of their fundamental experience of life. Perhaps the closest we can think of in the United States today to what a common reader might be are the people who buy lectures of this sort, are people who enjoy the materials they get from the teaching company. The ideal of a common reader, the ideal of an audience of amateurs who love what they who love the material for its own sake and are engaged by books, engaged by ideas, not because it's part of their professional life, but because it's part of their intellectual and moral substance, is an ideal that Virginia Woolf's literary criticism sustains and honors. Perhaps her most important contribution as a critic is that of defining modernism itself, theorizing its new sense of inwardness and the weakening of generalized structures of belief and order. In the essay titled Modern Fiction, first published in 1919 and collected in The Common Reader, she says, for example, this: "Let us not take it for granted that life exists more fully in what is commonly thought big than in what is commonly thought small." It could be the motto of modern fiction, Joyce's motto, Virginia Woolf's motto. Let us not take it for granted that life exists more fully in what is commonly thought big than in what is commonly thought small. The small moment, the minor event, the evanescent instant that disappears in the moment of its occurring, that could be the subject of a novel, the subject of a story. It can justify the attentions of a painter or a poet. It's as a novelist, however, that Virginia Woolf remains a central figure. There's a lovely trajectory to her career as a novelist, carrying further and further into the implications of her consciousness that human nature had changed. Remember the line that I quoted in the earlier lecture, "On or about December 1910, human character changed." And she pursues the implications of that, pursues the implication of the way in which she was newly aware of the implications of human inwardness, of the full import of our recognition, her recognition, the culture's recognition of human subjectivity. From The Voyage Out in 1915, her first novel, to her breakthrough novel, Jacob's Room, with its oblique narrative and impressionistic style, to her great central masterpieces, Mrs. Dalloway, 1925, and To the Lighthouse, 1927, and then to the austere, probing lyricism and symbolic concentration of such novels as The Waves, 1931, The Years, 1937, and her posthumous novel, one of her most remarkable symbolic books, Between the Acts, 1941. I want to try to capture something of Wolf, of the essence of Wolf's literary art, and at the same time, ground some of what I've been saying in the text I'm going to look at in the next lecture, To the Lighthouse, in two sentences, in two passages. The first is an early sentence from very early in To the Lighthouse, and it captures something of Wolf's essential ambition. It's a single sentence. Disappearing as stealthily as, this is from To the Lighthouse, disappearing as stealthily as stags from the dinner table, directly the meal was over, the eight sons and daughters of Mrs. Ramsay sought their bedrooms, their fastnesses in a house where there was no other privacy to debate anything, everything, Tansley's tie, the passing of the Tansley's is a visitor in that living with them in the house, a disciple of Mr. Ramsay. To debate anything, everything, Tansley's tie, the passing of the reform bill, seabirds and butterflies, people, while the sun poured into those attics, which a plank alone separated from each other so that every footstep could be plainly heard, and the Swiss girl sobbing for her father, who was dying of cancer, in a valley of the Grisson, and lit up bats. The grammar's been threatened there, but the subject is the sun, which had poured into those attics, and then was its presence in the sentence was at least deferred or occluded by various clauses. It also lit up bats, flannels, straw hats, ink pots, paint pots, beetles, and the skulls of small birds, while it drew from the long frilled strips of seaweed pinned to the wall a smell of salt and weeds, which was in the towels too, gritty from sand, gritty with sand from bathing. Well, I haven't counted the number of words in that long sentence, but it's a good-sized paragraph. It's a single sentence. Wolf uses semicolons to separate certain parts of it, and it has certain qualities that are worth, definitely, deeply worth considering and thinking about. Several things to notice especially have to do with the way in which the grammatical clarity of the sentence is threatened but not quite undone. I had to stop in the middle of reading it. Looking at it makes it easier because you can look back and find the grammatical relations. Hearing it aloud makes it even more difficult to see whether the grammar is still functioning. The grammar is threatened in the sentence, but not quite undone. There's a sense of an almost random accretion of details, as if the voice in the sentence, rushing on, must pause to pick up a detail nearly missed. There's also a sense of spontaneity, but also tension, a fear that everything won't be caught, everything won't be got in, as if the complexity and richness and discreteness of the world eludes or resists grammatical and verbal formulation. Something of the random wonder and particularity of the world is present in that long sentence as well. Things and people, inner lives and private memory, worlds within that cannot or will not be shared, all crowd into that long, elaborate, ungainly, nearly ungrammatical sentence before it's over. And when we come to its conclusion, we don't feel that it's come to some sort of grand finale in which things have been finally summed up in some way. What we feel, in fact, that it's come to a kind of arbitrary stop, as if the world's particularity, as if the world's concreteness and recalcitrance won't yield itself to cognition, won't yield itself to language. This danger, this threat that experience will resist understanding is often at the heart of the verbal complexity and energy of Wolf's prose and of the consciousness of some of her most interesting characters. Lily Briscoe, the painter in To the Lighthouse and the surrogate for Virginia Woolf, is perhaps the best embodiment of these, the character who best embodies an awareness of these principles in To the Lighthouse. I want to read one other passage in which Lily herself is the central figure. Lily begins a painting in part one of To the Lighthouse and completes it in the many ways sad and unhappy third part, the coda section that ends To the Lighthouse. I want to read a passage that describes Lily's painting, and describes Lily working on her painting, trying to figure out how to make the painting work, how to complete the painting. As she's reflecting on this, on the problems of her painting, she's also remembering her life 10 years earlier in this same place, on this same island in the Hebrides, where Lily had joined the Ramsay family for a summer. Mrs. Ramsay is now long dead, and one of the things she's doing is remembering Mrs. Ramsay as well. She's thinking to herself and trying to figure out what to do with her painting. And she remembers Mrs. Ramsay as that woman sitting there writing under the rock, resolving everything into simplicity. She made these angers and irritations fall off like old rags. In other words, she's remembering Mrs. Ramsay as the mother figure in the novel, and a dear friend of Lily's, although a friend Lily is sometimes impatient with, for reasons I'll explain in the next lecture. She remembers Mrs. Ramsay as someone who can bring some sort of coherence and simplicity to that disparate quality, that disintegrative quality that was present in the sentence I read earlier. That woman sitting there writing under the rock resolved everything into simplicity, this moment of friendship and liking. And there it stayed in the mind, affecting one almost like a work of art. And then she goes on thinking a bit more and then thinks, she thinks about how she'd always wondered about the meaning of life, what the point of experience was. And then this final passage. The great revelation had never come. The great revelation perhaps never did come. Instead, there were little daily miracles, illuminations, matches struck unexpectedly in the dark. Here was one, Mrs. Ramsay bringing them together. Mrs. Ramsay saying, life, stand still here. Life, stand still here. We might say that that ambition to make life stand still here, if only for a moment, in a painting, in a poem, in a novel, is one of Woolf's central ambitions.